remember it was blue, plain blue, I think. And I hope it was no kind of an heirloom, because I don't think I ever gave it back. Oh, hello, Cornelius here, Cornelius Lysett with episode 14 of the Cornelius Cast. Hope you're well. I was just recalling Derby Day 2006, the year that Sir Percy won the Derby. And I got there early as always, best part of the day actually on those big occasions, Epsom, Cheltenham, Aintree, etc. The lull before things really kick off. And I discovered I didn't have a tie. But happily, to my rescue came my then BBC colleague, formerly a leading flat jockey, now an outstanding pundit on ITV and Sky. Yes, the one and only Jason Weaver. And I'm really pleased that he's with us on the Cornelius Cast today. Hope it wasn't a family heirloom.
Oh my word, how time has flown, hasn't it? That seems, wow, I can't believe it's that long ago.
Yeah, 2020 less 2006, 14 years ago, is it?
Yeah. I think, if I remember rightly, I was doing the gentlemanly thing of, I had a spare tie in the car, you were in trouble, you looked like you'd possibly enjoyed your evening the night before and maybe
left in a bit of a hurry. It's the night before. It would have been Oaks night at Derby the next day. How dare you?
Yeah, exactly. No. Oaks evening. You'd had a nice dinner. That's all I'm saying.
But you'd retired from riding in 2000, so you'd had a year or two of doing bits and pieces, and you were on board. You were on board for Motivator 2005, and probably a couple before that as well with the BBC.
Yeah, I was lucky that you took me under your wing, and I got a run out, and I'd obviously filled a little pundit spot, and it sort of snowballed from there. And it was something that I really, really enjoyed it. I think I had a great time. Thought we had a great squad. There was a great balance of professionalism and fun, which I think is what's needed.
And I think we'll come on to ITV in a second, but I think you have, not as indeed as everyone else involved at ITV, have got that, because especially when you're on ITV1, clearly the audience is partly people who are interested in the racing at Ascot or the racing at Epsom or whatever, but also it's the casual viewer, and you don't want to just toss them away, do you? And Five Live was very much like that. News and Sports Network, people are turning on to find out, you know, the latest about some drama around the world, but suddenly you've got the Derby as well. So it's got to be, it's quite an interesting balance to try and strike, isn't it? I think racing needs to do that, possibly even needs to do even better than it does at the moment.
Yeah, there's still, you know, I speak to a friend of mine literally the other day, and he said he went in and he wanted to have a fiver or £2 or whatever it was on a race, and he turned on one of the specialist channels and he heard someone saying it was, you know, five lengths behind and £2 this and went three wide and was such and such and 2.4 and XYZ. He said, I ended up turning it off. You know, it was all a little bit too much. Yeah, you're right. There's a fine balance. You can't dumb it down.
Because there's a place for all that as well, isn't there? There is a place on
Absolutely.
The specialist channels for it is £2 better off compared to when they met at Beverly a week ago on Tuesday.
100%. And if there is that huge variety of people, do you know what I think that we should do a bit more is the jargon busters, and things just to try and break it down and make it more accessible.
I did a piece in the Racing Post the other day talking about jargon, because all sports have plenty of, all walks of life have plenty of jargon. I know you're a big golfer. I personally find myself following golf sometimes, and I don't really know whether it's an eagle, an albatross, a par or whatever. And I think racing has made a real, and Five Live to an extent led the way of making the effort, and on ITV the effort is made. But I think the importance is to actually do it sort of subtly, so it doesn't sound as though you're dumbing down. Oh, let's have a jargon moment. You know, that doesn't work really either, because you don't want to put off the people who do know what it means.
Yeah, we were talking the other day about horses changing their leads, and you know they have the gates, don't they? The walk, trot, canter, and gallop. And Dettori did a brilliant bit of moving his body weight on Enable as she came into the straight to switch out onto her near four, as we would call it, the near four, because that's the side of the horse that you deal with all the time. That's where you lead them from. That's where you get legged up on. And there are things like that that people just don't know. And with a normal horse, for argument's sake, if you're picking or cleaning the horse's feet out, you would do that all from one side on the racehorse. You would do the 4 feet from the near side, i.e. their left-hand side. Whereas with a normal horse, you would walk the full way round and do, you know, two each side. There are all these different things that could just make for... Just make it, you know, somebody to sit up in their chair and go, oh, I actually learned something today. And we mustn't forget sight of that. And we've got to keep striving to be better.
Yeah, as you rightly said, it's the balance is really important. You mentioned Dettori, Frankie Dettori. He's very much part of your story, isn't he? Because, you know, 1994, we thought 2006 was quite a long time ago. 1994, these are really interesting stats. In fact, we'll come on to them in a second, because I'll tell you what I wanted to say to you first of all, was the first time I ever met you was at Doncaster. And this would have been about, I think you were champion apprentice, weren't you?
Yeah.
1993, champion apprentice, 60 wins. And there was just this great story that I'd heard about, because you come from Chepstow, I think, home of the Welsh Grand National, but home of Jason Weaver as well. And is it true that your parents went out one day and they had a fridge freezer in the garage, and when they came home, it had gone, and you told them?
Yeah.
Go on, tell the story.
My sister's a couple of years older than me, Samantha, and she was more into the ponies than I was. And, you know, we started to go pony riding up in Trellick. Then there was obviously the next process was hopefully getting a pony. So we didn't, you know, we weren't extremely flush, if you like. And we had a pony to share. So my sister, being older, she rode it all the time. I got to ride it back to the field when it was exhausted after its days out riding or whatever. And I just never felt that I was getting the fair deal. Well, anyway, I found a pony in a field across the estate. The woman owned it, called Wendy Hoy. It had terrible laminitis. Feet were overgrown and nearly turned up. Little 12-2 dapple grey called Volvo. So I said, look, I've got £25 saved up. Can I have him? She said, well, that's not enough. So I walked her across the estate to our garage, and we had one of those big open chest fridge freezers, you know, that you used to open up like that and have, you had enough in there to last us 3 winters. Anyway, everything, frozen like a piece of concrete in there. And so I said, well, that, you know, the fridge freezer and the 25. And she said, yeah, great. So we wheeled it across the estate to her house, and I brought the pony home, tethered it in the back garden. My mother came home, went up the wall, finally let me get away with it. Because as you know, the sun always shines out of your backside when you are the only son in the household. So my mother let me off.
And what sort of age were you when you were doing this first bit of horse dealership?
Yeah, I was probably around the age of about 11 or 12, somewhere around there.
This is impressive.
Listen, it was a great time. The pony was a little sod of a thing. He would throw you off in a heartbeat, but he was just brilliant to learn to ride on. And that was where it started. And it's funny you should mention that about Wendy Hoy. So we were on ITV the other day, and we got asked a question, Francesca, what was her first pony? And she said, I don't know, Rhubarb or something. And I said, oh, mine's Volvo. And sure enough, someone tweeted to Francesca straight away, and it was Wendy Hoy who sold me that pony. And she said she wants her money back because the fridge freezer had just gone wrong that week. And that was literally about a week ago.
And I imagine the freezer might have been filled with quite a lot of boiled rice and apples, because it was said that before you went to the racing school, and you were you struggling on the weight front, or did your mother want to keep you as slimline as possible? She fed you on boiled rice and apples.
No, I was lucky at school because I really, really enjoyed rugby. My games teacher was Brian Price, who used to play for Pontypool. And so I represented Newport Schools and Gwent at at rugby, and then lost a few teeth and broke a few ribs and realised that maybe I wasn't the right size, but was a little bit portly. So my mother put me on boiled rice and apples, because at that time, to get into the British Racing School back then, you had to be under 7 stone. So I starved myself to get down then to manage to get into the racing school.
And so was this a natural progression from Volvo the pony? You liked the pony, rugby was fun, but riding horses seemed sort of more realistic.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I absolutely loved riding horses. And, you know, when the ponies, you can only go to a certain level. You know, I was only Gymkhana level, so I wasn't up to BSJA, and David Broome's was just around the corner. So I used to go and be chalk boy on the weekends for the Wales and the West shows for all the big show jumping.
On the sort of, on the number boards.
The number board, whoever was going in, they'd come in the collecting ring and warm up, and I would do the chalk board and get them all in order, and then shout up to the box who was coming in. Number 23, next, blah, blah, blah. And obviously, I would get an extra couple of quid if somebody came in late because their horse was a little bit difficult, and I would jump them up and get them in the wrong order. But I'd get a couple of quid later on in the evening at Broomy. So I was always trying to smell out a pound or two, but that was great. But my ponies weren't good enough to compete there. So the next progression was to try and get on a racehorse. And luckily, Milton Bradley's was just around the corner. I'm in Port Stewart. Milton's in Chepstow, so it was only, you know, 15 minutes away, 15 minutes away. Yeah, so I went there, and Milton took me on at weekends as a kid. So I'd finish school on a Friday, go straight there, stay over, work Saturday, Sunday, come home Sunday evening, and back to school.
Gosh, but then that was a big step forward to go to the racing school.
Yeah, massive.
What weight were you? So you were under 7 stone.
Well, yeah, I had to get down to something ridiculous. You know, I probably left school and was about, around about 9 stone, something like that. And then just went on the boiled rice and apples for 6 weeks. My mother said, if you're hungry, go to bed. I think I've never slept so much for 6 weeks.
And what was the racing school? What was moving away from home, moving away from South Wales to Newmarket to the racing school? What was that like?
I always joke with my boys now, they're 15
Max
and 17.
Tyler.
I left school on Friday and started work on Monday. And that's literally how it was. I left school on the Friday, loaded up the car, travelled up here. Luca Camani had kindly said that he would take me on for a couple of weeks before I went to the racing school.
So what was the link? How did that link come about? Luca, the father of Francesca, clearly.
Yeah, so I'd sent my CV off, if you like, to the British Racing School. They'd offered me a place. They found me a place with Luca, but it wasn't set in stone that I was going to go back. I was with Luca for a couple of weeks. Then I went for my 9-week course at the racing school, and it was up to him whether he wanted to take me back on after that process.
And when you went to Cumanis, was Frankie Dettori there as well?
Yeah, Frankie was there.
That's where he started.
Yeah. I think he'd ridden a couple of winners, hadn't he, as a kid over in Italy. And obviously his father, a multiple champion. He was already at Lucas. He was down the bottom yard. I was at the top yard. There was Ray Cochran was stable jockey. We had Ray Guest, who was second jockey. And we had Ray McGinn, who was third jockey. And then there was Frankie Dettori, who was apprentice. We had Colin Raitt, who's still in town now. He was apprentice. There was, at one brief time, Jimmy Fortune came, and he was second to Frankie. And I was lucky enough that I was champion apprentice for Luca.
And do you remember meeting Frankie for the first time? What was his English like then?
Oh, terrible, terrible. You know, he lived with a lad called Lodgie, who had been in the town for years. And Lodgie, you know, lovely, lovely guy. And he would say to Dettori, apple and pears, stairs. And this was how he learnt his English off this mad guy who was working at Lucas. And of course, you know, his pidgin English was part of his charm, wasn't it? Lucas, back then, it was a real family atmosphere. We had paid lads who came in just to ride out. We had senior lads and lasses who worked and were there all the time. We had Sammy Avis, who was travelling head man. He's now the starter at the race course all the time. We, you know, and those older guys looked after you all the time, whether it was out down the town in the evening, whether we were playing five-a-side football, whatever we were doing, it was an absolute family unit. And we were all pulling. We were all there in that yard to do our absolute best for the governor.
And it sounds, by the tone of your voice, it sounds as though you and Dettori had quite a lot of scrapes and fun, as well as working hard for the Luca Cumani team. There was a lot of fun involved, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, you're young, you're just full of so much zest and energy. And, you know, it was a brilliant time. And luckily, you know, not only did he look after us and tell us off, but he also, he was there to sort of guide you down the path.
So, therefore, this does almost read like a movie script. 1994, it's you against Dettori to be champion jockey. And the numbers are that he ended up, Dettori, with 233 winners and you with 200. Certainly, at the time, for a long time, it was the case, it may well still be, that you're the only jockey to have ridden 200 winners in a season and not been champion jockey. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Because the other time was Jamie and Seb.
Spencer
they
and Sanders.
They both rode over 200. And they were joint champion. Whenever anybody asked me, I said, "Oh yeah, but that was when Dettori was good and he wanted it," you know. So that's my throwaway line all the time. But it was a real battle, brilliant hammer and tong battle.
But considering what good mates you obviously were, that added a fascinating extra sort of nuance, because most good mates, when however good you are, however friendly you are with someone, you're in that kind of struggle. There tends to be a bit of backbiting. Did you stay good friends that year?
I think he was fine when he was in front, and then when he was behind, only momentarily, you know, by a winner or something like that, he got pretty narky. And, look, he was looking at what I was riding that day. I was looking at what he was riding that day. He was chasing around. He had Andy Keats, who was driving him. I had Mick Guest, who was driving me, who's now Ryan's driver. You know, we were full tilt up and down the country, you know, just chasing around like absolute madmen. So there was some needle, but, you know, not, you know, life or death aggressive, but just some healthy needle, some aggression.
And what about you? Because we all know, those of us who've worked with you in the media, know that you are Mr. Cheery, Mr. Nice Guy. Would your driver, who now drives for Ryan Moore, would he say, "Oh, you ought to have seen him in 1994? Or would he say you retained your good spirits?
No. Hey, listen, I like to, bounce along, be happy and everything else. If I'm being totally honest, the amount of sweating, wasting and everything else that I did didn't do me particularly good from a mental perspective.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
I really wasn't in a particularly good spot, if you like.
So how bad a spot were you in? Because you were struggling on the weight front, weren't you, even then?
Yeah, massively. But of course, you know, then there was also, it was the sweating, there was the use of Lasix, as in piss pills, as they were known back then. It was a vicious cycle. There was definitely too much drinking, too much sweating, and your body, or the human body, is a tremendous piece of machinery if you look after it properly. And I'd never ever question myself in a finish. It didn't matter if I was racing Pat Eddery, Mick Kanaan, Chris McCarron, Corey Nakatani. It just didn't matter. I always thought that I could win. And the last few months before I decided to call it a day, I wasn't operating at the same level. I wasn't able to go and produce what I wanted to do out on the track. I wasn't a particularly nice person, I don't think. I'm very, very snappy and aggressive, and it was getting worse.
Most sports people aren't that good at recognising that and deciding that things have got to change.
It had been coming. You know, you get up in the morning, I'd shout at myself.
So we're in 2000 now, aren't we? We're basically just after turn of the century.
Yeah, and I'd get up in the morning and I was getting on the scales, and if I had to get six off, it was an easy day. And, you know, so the bath was always run, the heater was in there, the baby oil was in the bath, and my I would have my bobble hat on and I'd lie in the bath and, you know, intermittently.
Well, with a hat on.
Yeah, intermittently, you know, sweat away. And obviously that takes its toll. And as I said, the body is a great piece of machinery and I could still operate at a high level. I had a nasty fall at Catterick and I'd driven there in my sauna suit. I probably took £6 off on the way up there. And I rode and I had a fall and I suffered multiple bruising and concussion, no fractures. And I spent a week in Catterick Military Hospital. And I think the reason that I had such severe concussion was because I had no fluid in my system. And so my brain was just knocked against the skull. It took a long time for everything to come right after that. And I, you know, if I was to lie back now and again, I can still get the odd double vision and bits and pieces. And it's all from having a real good clatter around the head.
And it's the, you know, if you look at your numbers from the mid 90s, 294, 144 winners in 95, 129, 100 in 1997, then down to 59 in 1998. Was that because you were just struggling to cope?
Yeah. I was still trying to operate at the same level. And, you know, the daily grind of doing what I was doing. And obviously you're not your chirpy, chipper self. And, you know, I could still operate. I could still ride. And, it was still... And because you lead such a blinkered approach to life, and I can see it in the lads now, you know, and I know exactly where they are and I see them walk out and how they're operating. And thankfully they have they're much better nutrition-wise at the moment. So hopefully they're going to have a healthy career later on. So I've led that blinkered approach. I'm not going to do anything else. I am a jockey. I'm going to be champion. I'm doing it. And then I was supposed to ride at Windsor on the Monday. And I went into the kitchen and I rang Fiona and I said, look, I said, that's it.
This is your partner.
And yeah, she knew it was coming. And I had a good cry in the kitchen anyway. I was supposed to ride for Jeremy Nasida. So I rang him, told him I'm not going, why it was. And he said, have you got anything worked out? What are you going to do? And blah, blah, blah. And I said, look, I've got nothing worked out. All I know is that I'm just in a bit of a dark space at the moment. And I need to reorganize where I am and what I'm doing.
Well, that was the sort of less happy side. But I just need to say names to you like Mr. Bailey's, Bijou Dawn's, Gothenburg, Lend a Hand, Quick Ransom, Page Boy, Pipe Major, Double Trigger, Double Eclipse. And they're all the happy names, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. To have been lucky enough to ride a 2000 Guineas winner, a Gold Cup winner, a Prix de l'Abbé winner, you know, that's the spread, isn't it, as far as a jockey is concerned. Sometimes you
Very long races to very short races.
Yeah. You know, Double Quick was just outside the track record at Epsom when she won the Dash. But, you know, Heber Golf Rose was an absolute flying machine. 5 furlong machine. Unbelievable. You know, Double Trigger, they don't make races far enough for him. He just could keep going all day long. Was a remarkable horse. And Mr. Bailey's was, whenever you think, they always say, don't they, oh, you know, he'd have been quick enough to win a July Cup, blah, blah, blah. He was quick enough to win over, you know, probably 5. Never mind 6, 7 and a mile. So, you know, he was a wonderful, wonderful horse.
And he beat Grand Lodge, ridden by Frankie Dettori.
Frankie Dettori,
a short head. Could Dettori not have ridden Mr. Bailey's? Was that
yes,
right?
Yes. I got the job for Mark Johnson.
Trainer of Mr. Bailey's, yeah.
I was booked to be stable jockey, but the only horse I wasn't guaranteed the ride on was Mr. Bailey's because he was the best horse that they'd had. You know, he'd won the Royal Lodge, Dettori had won on him, blah, blah, blah. So I thought, well, look, you know, there's still 100 horses or whatever it was then. I said, you know, it's fine, it's one horse. And then when it came down to it, Grand Lodge, Dettori had sat on him. You know, you're going to go for Lord Howard de Walden down in Newmarket for William Jarvis, or you're going to ride the 20-1 shot for Mark Johnson coming down from the north who hadn't won a classic since, you know, Pancake Tuesday, whenever. He chose wrong, and thankfully for me, the rest, as they say, is history.
And I imagine there must have been, as they say in the modern parlance, the banter that must have followed you beating Dettori on that occasion.
Yeah,
did he take it well?
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very cool. And maybe it flustered him underneath, but his shirt certainly didn't show it, and he patted me on the back. And that morning of the guineas, pretty sure we finished riding out, and I said, I'll come to yours, you know, and read the paper and blah, blah, blah. So I'd been to his, I'd used his men's room for want of a better description, Cornelius. I'd been and had a clean out. So I go and beat him a short head in the guineas. Literally, the next year, we're both riding in the guineas. We finished riding out at Lucas, and I said, I'm coming to yours for breakfast. You're not coming to mine. You're not coming to mine. You came last year. You know what happened last year. You go to your own house. So I wasn't allowed. I was trying to retrace the steps and doing everything exactly the same, but he was too wise to it. He wasn't having it.
Yeah. Thinking of those names that I mentioned, and there were, you know, I just picked out six or seven. There were dozens of them. I think the Goodwood Cup, when Double Trigger, ridden by you, beat Double Eclipse, his brother, ridden by Tyrone Williams, was it?
Yeah,
conceding a stone and a half in an that's one of the most epic, gripping races I think I've ever seen. I sort of held my breath through these two brothers taking each other on, one conceding lots of weight to his little brother, and you came out on top. That was a great day.
Oh yeah, brilliant. And he was a wonderful, wonderful horse. You know, I think back about characters and, you know, horses with attitude. And, you know, I remember going down to the bottom of the gallop, and he tried to sort of ship me off and give a massive buck and a kick with his flaxen mane and tail. And I reached around, caught hold of him and give him two liveners round the backside to let him know I was there. And he worked really well. And this was before he'd ran. And I thought, oh, we just might have one here. He was a great horse, Ron Huggins, extremely lucky owner, very competitive. And you talk about his brother. I think his brother, dare I say it, would have been a better racehorse, but he just didn't
have... What, Double Eclipse?
Yeah, he just didn't have the same physical attributes. Mechanically, he wasn't as good. His legs weren't as good.
And Double Trigger didn't do things the easy way, did he? He won a breathless Gold Cup at Royal Ascot. And he went off. And this is something people won't remember. Obviously, if he'd won, it would have been news around the world. But he went off, ridden by you, I think, as favourite for the Melbourne Cup.
Yeah, yeah. He was 1-2 or something like that for the Cadran.
In France.
And got beat. He wasn't as good on soft ground. So, yeah, he goes over to Melbourne. The jockeys get introduced to the crowd, so they say, number one, Jason Weaver, Double Trigger, and you put your hand up, and there was 100,000 Aussies screaming, and I thought, wow, you know, this is a pretty big deal.
Quite a long way from the fridge freezer in the garage, isn't it?
Oh, my word, and, you know, the whole build-up, everything was spectacular, and like nothing I'd ever experienced before, and so I'm walking out the tunnel at Flemington, and you go out of the paddock and you go right, and then you turn left out onto the track. So as I'm walking down the chute, some Aussie guy, bearing in mind it's the first time I'm racing for £1 million or whatever it was, and some Aussie guy leans over the barrier. Go on, Weaver. You know, you can do it, Trigger. You show him, that sort of thing. You know, and I sort of give him the thumbs up as if, you know, I've got this one in the bag, buddy, don't you worry. So we canter off down the post, and he never picked the bridle up. He got squashed all over the place. He was up in the air. He got beat from here to the clock tower in Newmarket. My chin is on the floor, right? I think he's going to win the greatest race ever. I'm walking back in, and I can't tell you the exact words because it's far too strong, but I was told by the same guy gripping that can of VB beer, hey, Weaver, back to England, you pommy. And take your dog with you. So listen, I got, that's the last thing I needed at that particular time. So yeah, it was as much as he gave me great highs, Double Trigger, that has to be a low point.
When you retired, you said this is a window of opportunity to do something else. And it was the media that you chose. And we know that you did a bit for the BBC, plenty for the racing channels. But it's ITV where I feel you've really come into your own. Do you know what you do? You've got that humour, you've got that ability to describe what's going on, but you've done it. And that is the crucial thing. Every time we stood next to each other at Epsom on Derby Day and you talked about coming around Tattenham Corner in the lead, in the derby, on Mr. Bailey's, whose stamina then ran out. So he finished, was he about fourth, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah.
That's what you're so brilliant at, is having done it, conveying to the viewer, conveying to the listener, conveying to the reader what it's actually like.
I must get better, and I must spend a bit more time when I'm on the golf course thinking about the best ways to describe what it's like, what it feels like, how it is. There's a fine line, isn't there, between having to say what you see, and then sometimes, you know, when people will say, oh, you're back in the jockey's corner, you're back in his corner, but I'm not. I know the situation where it was.
But how do you manage that? Because I find if I'm reporting on something, and I know owners, trainers, jockeys, whatever, and you've got to be careful when you know them, because you don't want to sort of lose all your friends.
Yeah.
But then equally, you don't want to climb up their noses, so to speak, and be overly complimentary. And not everyone's that good at that. You seem, you know, you and Dettori, how do you manage to sort of make it seem not be overly familiar? Because you know him like, you know, one of your best mates.
We had one falling out. He'd had a bad time. He'd been sacked. You know, it was the whole Godolphin thing. And he rode one, I think it was for Andrew Balding, in the Stayers race at Ascot. He gave it an absolute shocker. And, you know, I could see things weren't going right for him. He's having a bad time, you know, after all his brilliant run and carrying racing on his back for so many years. But I had to say it as it was. And I said, well, you know, he just couldn't win on anything at the moment. You know, his confidence from a professional sportsman was through the floor, and I said as much, and he rang me that night, and he went off on one, and I said, look, I am sorry, but you've never once rang me for all the times I've said you're brilliant and said thank you, and I've just said what I saw, and you weren't that good. And then he thought about it for, I don't know, a few seconds, and he went quiet, and he went, look, I'm sorry, I'm just having such a bad time at the moment, and I needed to let it out. And I said, that's fine, you know, and I'm not 100% not going to fall out with you over it. And I've had one or two of them along the way, but
I bet you have, yeah.
But you've
inevitably,
you know, yeah. And do you know one of the lads who worked so hard at the game, Daniel Muscat? He rode one as close as last night, and it finished second. It was slowly away. Maybe that's not his fault. It was first time out. But he came down the straight, and it was leaning left-handed the whole way down there. And for me, having grown up under the wing of Luca and Ray Cochran, in that scenario, the whip comes through immediately, and you straighten your horse up, and you get him back on an even keel and running through. And he's beaten a length or half a length or three parts or something like that. Anyway, this is a fully fledged rider who's riding for some of the best operations in the world. He picked his whip up with his right hand and gave him another tap, and he's coming down there side on. Now, for me, that's an absolute cardinal sin. It's like watching a jockey. If I see some of the kids today or any of the older riders going into a right-handed turn with the whip in their right hand, what's that all about? You have to be ambidextrous. You must be. There are all these little things that you need to be able to do correctly to
move the whip from one hand
to
another.
Top level.
And the other thing about knowing everybody is also, and I think some in the media are certainly guilty of this, is sort of showing off how much they know. Sort of almost sort of putting answers into people's mouths, etc., when chatting to them. Because you know, there's a barbecue in Newmarket. Presumably, you bump into, you know, or you know these people socially. Or you've ridden against them in the past?
Yeah. But I knock around with Mick Fitzgerald when we're up and down the country playing golf on the golf course. I wouldn't sort of knock around with the jockeys of today, and all the youngsters coming through wouldn't have been riding when I was riding anyway. You know, I spend a lot of time with my boys doing their golf and this, that and everything else for when I'm not working.
Well, you mentioned your boys a couple of times. There's Max and Tyler.
Yeah.
Which one's older?
Max is the eldest.
Max. They're not into horses, are they? But they're superb golfers.
Yeah, we had a pony for Max. He enjoyed it. He could ride. I mean, if we turned up at a riding centre now, he'd be fine. You could throw him up and he could get on with it. But the pony had to go because it was never getting used. And Tyler's in the regional squad for England, and he's a scratch golfer. And Max, the eldest, he's about a 1 point something at the moment. 1 point something, maybe 2, something like that.
So what, you're effectively a trainer on that, or you're in a position of a trainer, racehorse trainer, aren't you? Because they're your two boys. So what are you like on the other side, not being the actual competitor, but being a bit of a manager for the two boys?
Yeah, do you know what? I've seen so many parents, pushy parents, and I don't want to be that. I'm not trying to relive anything or do anything. I'll try and give them the best advice that I can try and give them. They're better golfers than me, so I can't really tell them anything about golf. They can get trained by better people. But from a mental perspective, and I think all things with people in whatever walk of life you are, find something that you're good at and commit yourself to that. Everybody's good at something. Find something that you're good at and give that a go. You've got to work at it. You've got to graft at it. We've just lost Pat Smullen. He found something that he was good at and he dedicated himself to that pursuit. And he could flick the switch and turn it on. And he was brilliant on numerous occasions at all levels of the sport. So find something that you're good at and focus on it. And that's what I tried to tell the boys.
Well, I think that's a really nice way of ending our little chat. You found something you were good at and you were a jockey. And dare I say, rather irritatingly, you found yourself into the media, and you found you're rather good at that as well. And good luck with everything with ITV and Sky, and keep smiling and keep on the golf course. When you've got that tricky putt to think about, you can also think about the what we were saying earlier on, how you convey some of the many things about horse racing, which is important. It's an important job for all of us to keep on doing. You know, racing is a great and enjoyable sport. Some people don't agree with that. But, you know, we've got to keep trying to convert people.
It's a multi-million pound industry. We've got to look after the horse. We've got to look after the people. It's time that we all, you know, really pulled in the same direction and did the best for the sport, because it's a wonderful arena.
Well, thank you to you, Jason, for joining us. And thank you to you for listening to this episode 14 of the Cornelius Cast. If you've enjoyed it, please spread the word, perhaps subscribe so you never miss an episode, and a little review if you get the chance to do that, if you've enjoyed it. And even if you haven't enjoyed it, that would be nice as well. Thanks for listening, and we'll chat again soon.